So we started the year 2020 in Proverbs, and we learned in Proverbs how to fear the Lord with all our strength. Then we moved on to the book of Ecclesiastes, where we learned how to fear the Lord with all of our mind. And then finally, last week, we let the Song of Songs teach us how to fear the Lord with all of our hearts. So imagine you've been thoroughly schooled by Solomon. You've been thoroughly schooled, put through the program of Solomon's wisdom. You've mastered the holy living of the Proverbs. Ecclesiastes has taken your understanding of God to unimagined depths, and Song of Songs has expanded your love for God in unimaginable ways. In all of these ways, you've completed the school, the program, and some reporter hears about you and this unique life that you are living, and they decide to come and to see you, to check you out for themselves. Are you really the real deal? Since you have nothing to hide, you allow them to follow you and observe your life and the way that you live and you interact with others and the way that you work. All of the aspects of your life are open. And in this like deeply invasive way, this reporter examines your life and assesses who you really are. And here's what they decide after looking at you. You are blameless and upright. You are one who fears God and turns away from evil. What would you make of this assessment? What might you be thinking if someone described you in this way? I mean, right now, I want you to like actually like imagine this. Someone has said that you are blameless and upright. You are one who fears God and turns away from evil. And they say this publicly. What are you feeling in that moment? No way. Not possible, right? They clearly don't know my thoughts. They can't see what's in my heart. They don't know my motivations. And yet this is exactly how the narrator of the book of Job describes Job to us. But it's not just the narrator who sees things this way. It's also Job himself. Later on, we'll get to chapter 9, but in chapter 9, verse 20, we actually hear Job say, though I am right, though I am blameless. Can you imagine describing yourself with these sorts of words? Blameless. See, Job sees himself as upright and blameless, and I think this can be a really hard pill for us to swallow. In fact, listen to people talk about Job, talk about this person in this book, and you'll hear people begin to explain something doesn't sit quite right with us about Job. We're not quite sure we want to say that he's sinful, but through this book, I mean, he will eventually end up wishing he's dead. He'll curse the day that he was born. He severely questions God throughout this book. For some, the very fact that Job describes himself as blameless and upright is enough to prove to us, right, that he's not upright or blameless. Nobody who says they're blameless is blameless. And yet, here we are. This is the description we have from the narrator, from Job. But it's uncomfortable, right? We all know a little too well how easy it is to deceive ourselves, to think more highly of ourselves than we ought to rationalize, to justify. And so we can understand how someone like Job might believe that they're upright and blameless. Because we know plenty of people who believe that they're upright and blameless. We might even be able to wrap our minds around someone coming along, getting a good look at Job's life and concluding, no, things seem to be pretty straightforward. He's upright and blameless. But we all know what's missing from that assessment. Right? There are desires, fears, cares that are completely hidden to any outside observer who looks at our behavior. And there are desires and fears and cares that are hidden from Job's own awareness. How much of our lives is driven by desires and fears and cares that we're not even aware of? How could we possibly declare that we are blameless and upright? So we're tempted to not believe Job, and we're tempted to disregard the narrator as well. But what happens as we're reading along and God himself shows up in the story and in verse 8 says, hey, have you considered my servant Job? There's no one like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man who fears God and turns away evil. God himself describes Job in this way, which leaves us with two options. One is we can trust what the scriptures say in other places about God, which is that while humans look at outward appearances, God looks at the heart, and we can assume based on what we're reading that God has seen what's inside of Job as well as what's outside, and he approves. And he speaks the truth in this moment. That's one option for how we make sense of this. Or we can follow the path of the adversary, and we could question Job's hidden motivations. But we have to know this, that if we question Job's motivations, then we're also calling into question God's ability to clearly see Job's motives. And we're also calling into question God's ability to rightly judge a person's moral character. And we're also calling into question the very world that God has created and God's justice. So there's a lot of questioning that comes into play when we begin to question who Job is in this passage. And so we're not really given a lot of options here. We can either stand with the narrator, with Job, and with God, or stand with the adversary. So how do we begin to make sense of it? Well, Job is clearly special in the world. This long book over the course of 42 chapters is going to help us understand why, what makes Job special. By the end of the book, we will see how Job's life actually points us toward Jesus. Job's life helps us to anticipate who Jesus will be and what Jesus will do for us. We'll see how the unjustly suffering of God's servant makes a servant the perfect person to intercede for sinners. The sacrifice that is made by the servant suffering unjustly will result in forgiveness. It will result in reconciliation for others. And it's followed by a resurrection for the one who lost everything in his suffering. This path from Job sitting in his ashes, humbled, humiliated, to Job 42 chapters later, restored and even resurrected. This is the story that we are actually participating in. This is the story that we are following through the season of Lent. As we journey from Wednesday nights or Wednesday mornings, Ash Wednesday service, where we sat humbled in our ashes, and we now move with Job and with Jesus, enduring the season of suffering and of seeking, in order to experience the fullness of resurrection that's to come. Our story over the next weeks parallels the story of Job. Job is this incredible book. I don't know if you've read it before, but while Job is a major part of the story, and we know the book by the name of this character, Job, and he's in nearly every scene of the book, we discover that Job is actually not the main character. This book, although it details Job's suffering, is actually not primarily about suffering. This book is about God. It is about God and the world that God created. Is God good? Can God be trusted? Is this world that we live in, is it rightly ordered by God? Where is God when the world is not as it is meant to be? Like, these are huge questions. And while the book of Job isn't specifically about suffering, through Job's suffering in this story, we recognize that it is often in our unjust suffering or the unjust suffering of the people that we love that these questions then feel the most pressing. Like when someone dies too young, when a child is hurt by an adult who is supposed to protect them, when kids are orphaned, when bad things happen to good people and when good comes to bad people, these are the circumstances where we often feel lost and we start to wonder, like, does God see us at all? Does God know what we are going through? How is any of this fair, and what is God going to do about it? Like, these are the questions that Job invites us to ask. These are questions that people are already asking. And so Job is an invitation to come and meet God in the midst of those questions, because this book will respond to those questions in some surprising and even unexpected ways. And so I want to take a look at who God is, how God shows up in our passage this morning. And so let's see what the book of Job has to say about him. The first five verses are focused on introducing Job, the man, to us. But then in verse 6, the scene cuts away from the earth, and we get one of the Bible's few peeks into God's domain. And I know we already read it, and some of you actually read it this week using the Daily Worship Guide, but I want to ask a question that I want some responses to. So if you can help and participate with this. Normally, when you picture God in heaven, what do you imagine God doing? Okay, that's the question I offer to you. Like, when you picture God in heaven, what do you usually imagine God doing? Feel free to throw out responses. Sitting on the throne. Doing anything on the throne? Okay, angels around him, worshiping. Okay, thanks. Offerings? Okay. What else? When you picture God in heaven, what's God up to? What's he look like? What's happening there? Watching us. Yeah, just checking things out. Okay, keeping order in the universe. Pursuing us. Anyone else? Okay, so God's just hanging out, big hands, holding the whole, like, actually holding the world. Cool. Well, you know, in these imaginations of what God is up to, is God alone? Is God with others? how exactly do these pictures sort of work themselves out? Like, how specific are they? Read along with me. Job 1, starting in verse 6, where we get this glimpse into what God is up to. Now there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and the adversary also came among them. The Lord said, I'm still reading. The Lord said to the adversary, "From where have you come?" The adversary answered the Lord and said, "From going to and fro on the earth and from walking up and down on it." Okay, so in my experience of reading this book with other people, this is not the picture that most of us have of God and what God is up to. And so the question is, what exactly is going on in this story? Well, let me try to help us picture it. There is a group of heavenly beings. They're not called angels. They're called the sons of God. Have presented themselves to the Lord as part of this group then that's come to him, these sons of God. There is a specific figure identified among them. So one of them is singled out. And in many of your translations, you will read, "Satan also came among them." However, Satan, the word Satan, is a transliteration of the Hebrew word Satan, a word that means adversary. But importantly, here in this passage and in other places as well, this figure is not named Satan or Satan in Hebrew. In Hebrew, the word "the" is right before it. The Satan. So this being isn't someone named Satan. It is a figure whose title is the adversary. The title tells us what this person's job is. And so this is really important for us as we read the story unfolding in front of us, because it keeps us from reading other sorts of ideas that are not connected to this story into it. This passage isn't God versus his arch enemy battling over Job. This isn't a story of good versus evil. This whole narrative revolves around God. Everything in this passage is God. And in this story, God is running a staff meeting. Probably sounds a little boring, but if he's rightly maintaining order in the universe, we've discovered that he's enlisted beings that he's created to help him do that. In other places throughout scripture, the sons of God are described as the divine council. Regardless of what you imagine when you think of God up in heaven, this is what the ancient Hebrews imagined. The sons of God are spiritual beings that we don't know a whole lot about, who live in the heavens, who are made by God to help him run the world. In verse 6, God is called a staff meeting. This divine council gathers around him and they come to bring him reports. Maybe you thought heaven was going to be more exciting than meetings. When it says that they present themselves before the Lord, what we're hearing is we're actually hearing the language of a king's officials who come to their king to make reports about the kingdom. This is ancient language, ancient ways of describing this dynamic of a king and his officials coming to him and giving him these reports. Throughout the scriptures, we get a few glimpses and who and what these beings are and what they do, but God seems to have given them a variety of roles and titles and tasks within his creation. For instance, one of them being the adversary. Now, scholars often describe this role and title like that of a prosecutor within a courtroom. So the prosecutor then would come into the God's court and is accusing Job of not being all he appears to be. There's another image that I really appreciate in thinking about the adversary. This is a bit more of a contemporary image. When I think about what the adversary is saying as we read this story, not only of Job, but also of God and God's world, it makes a lot of sense, although it sounds way less boring, way more boring, than the adversary is some like vicious enemy. The adversary as a quality assurance manager. Think about this with me. What is quality assurance? In the business world, there are two different kinds of quality assurance, two different ways of going about quality assurance in a company. So you have a company like Apple under Steve Jobs that was obsessed with quality assurance because they wanted the absolute best product to go out. And so Apple's quality assurance department pored over every line of code and every detail of every product, testing in order to provide the very best version of what they were trying to create. Compare this then with what we've learned about a company like Boeing recently. It was only after two planes crashed, killing hundreds of people, that people started to ask questions of Boeing and the products that they were producing. And in the midst of these questions, more and more details have come out showing that Boeing knew they were rushing production, that there were code issues in their product, and that the company was actually avoiding the kind of testing that might have revealed these problems and pushed back their production. So think about these two examples. In one instance, a company adopts quality assurance as an ally to make sure that it puts out the best possible product. The company asks quality assurance to test the heck out of the product, to come against the product as an adversary, looking for any flaw, tearing it apart, making sure that it's its best possible version. In the other instance, quality assurance is an obstacle or an enemy of profit. Right? Quality assurance comes with too many regulations, too many things to jump over. We need quality assurance in this second way to make sure that nobody gets hurt and we don't get sued. But quality assurance is something to do the bare minimum for in order to get around it and bring your product to market and make as much money as possible as soon as possible. Too often when we read the adversary here in Job as the enemy of God, we give this figure way more power and authority than he actually has in the story. He has nothing that the Lord hasn't given him. He's just following orders. There's no sense in which God ever has to get around this figure or get rid of him or defeat him. Rather, what you find is God freely submitting to the quality service adversary. The adversary thinks he's found a flaw in God's system. I mean, that's kind of amazing, right? To think that you're looking at this thing that God makes and you're like, aha, I got it. I know where this thing is gonna fall apart. I know where its weak spot is. I know why this thing is broken. The adversary thinks he's found a flaw in the whole system. And like a good employee, he reports this to his boss as it's his turn to report like everybody else. And what is God's response to the adversary? He says, put it to the test. Test the system. You think there's a flaw? Go ahead. Try to game it. Try to take advantage of it. See if my good creation has a design flaw after all. God's not fazed. He's not afraid. There's no concern. He doesn't feel like he has too many obstacles to get through. He says, do it, test it. That's your job. God is ready and willing to subject every part of the world that he created to the quality assurance tests of the adversary. Why? because God has nothing to hide. Because God knows when the test is complete, the results will be heavily in his favor. And as a result of this testing, there will then be significant evidence for the rest of us to trust God and the world that he's created. There will be a report that we can then assess and confirm this God is good and worthy of our trust. So in this way, actually, God's quality assurance team isn't like Boeing's, and it actually isn't quite like Apple's. God's not trying to produce the best world through a constant testing and refining. God's already made the world and called it good. His quality assurance team is there to prove that it truly is good and to share out the report for all who need the assurance. So chapter one introduces us, if you can imagine it, to God, the master CEO. And then we meet the sons of God, his managerial staff. We meet one of the sons of God, the adversary who runs the quality control assurance department, And then we meet Job, the potential flaw in God's creation. The adversary seems pretty concerned about what he's discovered, but God doesn't. God has seen the way that Job lives. But God also knows the stuff that Job is made of. God declares that Job is blameless and upright, that he fears God, and that he turns from evil. When he says this, he's testifying to Job's outer life and Job's inner life. He sees what the adversary cannot see. And yet, God allows his world, his servant, to be subjected to the rigors of quality assurance testing. Because in the end, Job will no longer be alone in fearing God, but now others will have a basis for fearing him as well. Before we finish this morning, I want to say something about the specific flaw that the adversary thinks he's discovered in God's design of the world. He looks at Job and he sees everything that Job has. And did you hear it? 7 sons and 3 daughters, 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, 500 female donkeys, very many servants, and a partridge in a pear tree. If you're not up on ancient exchange rates, 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camel, 500 yoke of oxen, 500 female donkeys, a bunch of servants, calculates out to like carry the one, an insane amount of wealth. So much. The narrator just summarizes Job's wealth by saying he's literally the greatest of all the people in the East. So like he had like more than anybody in a whole hemisphere. Like, think Solomon in the West, Job's got the East. The adversary has done the math. And in verse 10, he asks this question: have you not put a hedge around him and his house and all that he has on every side? You have blessed the work of his hands, and his possessions have increased in the land. But stretch out your hand and touch all that he has, and he will curse you to your face. All of this is summarized with the question in verse 9, just before it, where he says, does Job fear God for no reason? Does Job fear God for no reason? The adversary then lists the reasons why he believes Job fears God. He believes it's all of these things that keeps Job worshiping, that keeps God, keeps Job coming back to God. God has protected Job, and he's blessed Job with an insane amount of stuff. Of course, Job worships you. Of course, he fears you because he's getting paid by you to. You're rewarding him. Of course he is. And thus the design flaw, according to the adversary. See, God, according to the adversary, made a world where God isn't as attractive as the stuff that God made. Where God made a world where people trust God, but only because God protects them from harm or rewards them. But if God withholds his protection and his provision, the adversary says that people's true motivations will be revealed. They don't want God for God's sake. They want God for God's stuff. They don't want God for God's sake. They want God for God's stuff. This is the question that Job is asking of us. Do we want God for God's sake or only for God's stuff? And yet, the adversary understands that if God made humans to be in relationship with him, what's wrong with God or God's design if human beings cannot or do not want God? Where did God go wrong if human beings have to be bribed to fear him and walk with him? The adversary is questioning whether human beings can ever possibly love God with pure motives. This is a fascinating question, isn't it? Can we love God with pure motives? Especially knowing how corrupted our motives often are. How often we do things, good things, but not out of sacrificial, self-emptying, others-oriented love, but how often we do good things, even acts of love for ourselves, for what we might get out of it. Our motives are often deeply corrupted. And I think the adversary knows this as he looks at human beings, as he walks to and fro from around the earth. And so he's not quite sure it's possible for Job to be anything other than corrupted internally. Job's name is in the question. Does Job fear God for no reason? But we could replace Job with any other name, and the question still exists. Does Curtis fear God for no reason, or do I fear the Lord only because of fill in your name? We'll find out in the weeks to come how this all works out for Job. In the meantime, it's important for us to remember how it all worked out for Jesus. See, because Jesus is put to the same test. Not once, but again and again. The first of those, at least as the stories go that we receive, are when he's sent out into the wilderness. But then again on the night when he's betrayed and he finds himself in the Garden of Gethsemane, he's tested once again. Jesus was blameless and upright. He trusted his Father and he turned from evil. Jesus shows us what happens when God puts himself into the system. When he puts himself into the world that he designed and he subjects himself to the test. So it's not Job's motivation being tested and God's, but it's God's in every place. Jesus shows us what it looks like to love with pure motivation. He shows us God's love. A love that doesn't demand anything in return. A love that is truly, freely given. And Jesus tells us that this purity of love, this perfection of love that's seen in him is actually possible in us. That Jesus wants to purify our motivations, that he wants to purify our love. The season of Lent is a time when Christians regularly subject themselves to some self-inflicted suffering. We call it fasting, and it takes different forms. But what we discover in this practice is that it's not simply a test of ourselves, but it's a way of allowing Jesus to purify us. The season of Lent in many ways is rooted in Paul's claim. In one of the letters he wrote, he says, "I beat my body down that I might not be disqualified from the race." He recognizes that there is a deep purifying work that needs to happen in him that only God can do. And so what does that work look like in us? As I've been praying about, as I've been preparing for Job in this season, some of my prayers have gone something like, where my love is imperfect, I offer myself up to Jesus to purify my intentions. Where I want God's blessings more than I want God himself, I lay myself down before God. Where I want to become like God more than I want to submit to God, I ask that he would help me lay down before him. Where I want God because I think he'll protect me from pain, I lay myself down before him and ask him to preserve me through the pain. And in every way that I have fallen short, I am reminded again and again of the good news. The good news that God suffered unjustly at the hands of humans within the world he made by the humans he made. God suffered unjustly, making him uniquely qualified to forgive us, to cleanse us, to restore us, and to make us new. This is really good news. Because in every way that today I am not yet holy as he is holy, not yet who God made me to be, there is grace and there is forgiveness and there is a good God, a trustworthy God who will not give up on me until I, along with all of God's people, are transformed and radiate his perfect love and character. And until that day, when that is what describes each and every one of us, this radiating of God's perfect love and character, we can trust that God's world, this world that he has made, is good, and that he is in it, and that he is with us through it all. Amen.